session number 30135, reel 4.
Interview with Fergus Ancorn, Thursday the 26th of April 2007, in Westrum, Kent. Oh, it's good to see you, Fergus.
Good to see you too.
What's the weather been like down here?
Oh, super hot. That's why I've got my air conditioner, because the lady underneath... I never have heating on in this house, ever. Only if I have visitors. I put it on for you today. And if I want to defrost the fridge, because the kitchen is colder than the fridge. And I'm never cold. I'm incapable of being cold. Now, the lady underneath...
The day you were freed,
yeah,
this young boy came in.
It's
in the autograph book.
Yes, and look at the beautiful writing of that tired boy.
Congratulations for your freedom. The University of Moral and Political Sciences, Ubon, native town, and that is 17 September 1945. What extraordinary writing, what a hand.
Yeah, he was only about 16 or 17, and he wrote better than any of us. Mm. So, all sorts of nice things. I haven't looked at this for years, but that's the crowd that liberated us by parachute.
There's a lovely cartoon.
Don't know. I think my Dutch friend did that. Who signed it?
Percy Bowl or Bolt?
Oh, Percy Bolts. And now he was a fellow that I met in Norwich when we were here. Before we went abroad, and he liked magic as well. I used to do bits of magic there, and I must have shown him this, and he's done that long after the war. That would have been autograph book, and anyone that I knew, particularly, for instance, one of the colonels we were at was Lawrence of Arabia's ADC. He signed it. And that fellow was the organist at Salisbury Cathedral. He died out there. You've heard of Ronald Searle?
Yes.
That's a self-portrait of him.
Goodness me. Would you look at that. Haircut, Searle.
Because he was always in trouble for his long hair. He was in our concert
party. That was in 43. March 43.
Just taken. Shortly after we'd been taken. We were still at Changi then. And... this fellow here, Reg Renison,
yes,
concert pianist, he started an orchestra in Singapore when we were there for the first few months, and a lot of officers had their cellos and things with them, and he scored the Rachmaninoff number 1 piano concerto completely down to percussion on the backs of envelopes. And we had a piano there in the theatre, proper grand piano. And he had an orchestra of 16 people, mostly officers, and he played the Rachmaninoff number 1 with no music. And he'd scored it for every person in that orchestra on bits of paper out of his mind.
How amazing.
I remember saying to myself...
This was when you were in Alexandra Hospital.
Yes. As I was saying, I... kept going in and out of consciousness. I saw them coming in, killing everybody, and I said out loud to myself, it's over, this is the end, I'll never be 25. Now, why that was an important thing, I don't know. I thought, you know, I must have thought one day I'll be 25, and now I'm saying one day I won't. And then I must have passed out again, and they bypassed me. But the thing was, I think when you get the VC, it's not because you're brave. It's because it's the end. And you're going to do what you can, take as many with you. And why I say that is, on three occasions, I've said, it's all over. And at that moment, complete calm comes over you. Now, I couldn't have run out of that hospital if I'd wanted to, because I was... paralysed from here downwards for a long time. And when you're stuck there,
that's from the waist down with this injury that you had.
Yes, it was blasted, of course, and I had a lot of shrapnel in me all over the place, because when that lorry got hit, all the bomb splinters came in and wouldn't go out, so they were flying around in there, and I was being hit all over the place. And now, if I had only had my wrist injury, when those Japs came in, I would have jumped out of a window and tried to get away.
Yes.
Well, when you can't move and you're just stuck there like that and they're coming to kill you, you say, it's over. There's no point in doing any. Utter calm comes over you. And all those people being bayoneted, I never heard one person make a sound. Not a sound, not even the Japs. It's just like picking up bits of paper in the park, you know. And no one made a sound. And I think they must have been like me, just it's over, and just wait for it. And I think the same happens when you get a VC. You're in a cave and you've got 10 Germans coming in to kill you. You think, well, I can't get out. I'll kill as many as I can. And suddenly you find you've killed them all.
Yes.
And you get the VC. But there are very few people, I imagine, who would charge a Ford on something with the purpose of trying to get a medal. It happens. I mean, Lord Delisle and Dudley down the road here, he got the VC. He wiped out a whole German machine gun post. Mm. But he knew what he was doing. He said, we can't move unless that lot's put out of it. Give us a Bren gun. And he went over and did it, and fortunately didn't get killed.
Yes.
So I think it's one of those things that happens.
And you were aged 26, weighing 6 stone when you came home.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, those first few weeks at home, did you experience any problems?
Oh, yes.
Relating with the family or friends?
Oh, yes, relating to me. Now, to start with, my fiancée was a nurse, and she looked after me. And I went very funny in the head. And that was, as I said before, I couldn't believe I was alive. I couldn't believe it was over. And I was looking for trouble all the time. I would never go out unless it was dark night time. If by any chance I saw someone coming towards me, I would turn around and go the other way. I didn't want to meet people. And the main thing was, we couldn't identify with people. My mother said, talking about the war, she said, we only got 2.5 ounces of bacon a week. And I thought, 2.5 ounces? I've killed someone for that. Mm. And my sister, my elder sister, said, I suppose you were all right for fruit and that sort of thing. If they'd only known that we were eating maggots and mice and rats.
And you couldn't tell them.
You couldn't tell them. And
you felt that you...
For two pins, I would have liked to have gone back to the fellows again, where we'd all been together, because we knew what things were.
So you'd lost your point of reference with the people closest to you.
Oh, yes. Everything was fine. They were looking after me, and it was wonderful to be back. But there was no point in telling them, look, I was eating scorpions and snakes and things. I did tell them that. The only thing I didn't tell them was the massacre. I thought I could see the effect it would have had on my mother to think of me. I remember when I was first done with that hand and I woke up in the hospital, I didn't know whether I had a hand or not. It was up there like this, and there was a fellow on the stretcher next to me, and I said to him, have I still got a right hand? And he put his hand up and he said, this little piggy went to market, and he counted each finger for me, which was terrific. He was one that was killed there too. And I remember thinking, while I was there, I was still bleeding an awful lot. And I remember that fellow on the stretcher, a doctor happened to walk through the ward. I mean, at that time, no one was around, and we were being shelled. The shells were coming in the ward, and it was our own shells, because they knew the Japs had got the hospital. And So nothing had been done to me, and this hand, which, this one, which he'd tidied up and put a tourniquet, it wasn't working, it was pouring blood all the time, and I didn't mind. And I remember saying to myself, I suppose I'm dying, because I didn't give a damn for anything. And I kept going off and then waking up, and I remember saying, I suppose I'm dying, poor mum. That's, you see, I knew I was there, she didn't.
Yes.
You know, she would be wondering. Now, when I got bombed that day...
In the camp, yes.
No, in action, and when I got the hand...
When you got the hand injury, sorry.
I ended up lying in a ditch, an anti-malarial drain ditch, unconscious and bleeding. And at that time, there was an official escape party. They had been given orders to try and escape. If you did it in any other way, you get court-martialed, of course. And I've got found that recently, the log of the trip. They had to try and get themselves down to the docks, get a boat or something, get out. One of them found me, a fellow from my regiment, turned me over and found out that I was dead, in his opinion.
Mm.
So took my dog tags off and went off to try and escape. And they got an open boat, and they did. They got through all the Japanese shipping and everything. They got to Sri Lanka 6 weeks later. And the first thing that happened was that they were debriefed. Do you know anyone in your regiment who was alive, dead, injured, or what? And he said, well, Gunnar Ankorn was dead. I found his corpse. And handed in my dog tags.
Okay.
So my parents were informed I was killed in action.
Oh, goodness.
And so they, as far as they were concerned, I was dead. Now, after a year or two, we were given a card we could send home, and I tell you, and I did a code by altering my signature.
Right.
Because we weren't allowed to write anything, you just signed your name, and I just signed
my
name.
This was a pre-printed card.
Yes, I'm well, I'm unwell, I'm working for pay.
So you delete as appropriate.
You crossed out. And in my signature, I altered it slightly so that I could get certain curves in it that would make my shorthand outlines. And when it arrived at home, which it did do, my mother said, that's... He's dead, he is dead, he really is dead. That's not my son's signature. Someone else has written that. And so she took herself off to bed, and my name wasn't allowed to be mentioned. There was gloom in the place, because they'd hoped all those years that I was alive. In fact, my mother used to send a card off every day, hoping that I was alive and that I might get one.
Mm.
And there it was, the proof that I was dead. It wasn't my signature. She went to bed, she must have been looking at that card, and she suddenly spotted it, read the message. Shrieked the house down, he's alive, he's alive, he's alive.
What had you written?
Well, when I was a baby, they called me Smiler. And when I went off the last time to go to war, my mother said to me, you keep smiling, whatever happens. Well, on that signature it said, still smiling. And she read it. And I got a card back from her. They were allowed to send 25 words on a card each week.
Mm-hmm.
And I got one back 9 months later. And all the usual trash, my dear boy, I hope you are well. It used to make us so angry, all that. Never mind about you, dear boy, I hope you are well. Tell us what's happening in the war, you see. And in the middle, she typed, also still smiling. So I now knew...
That she knew.
Yes.
That you were alive.
Now, in those crossings out, I was able to say, building a railway from Bangkok to Moulmein. I had taken my card to Colonel Toosey, because the Japs divided us into tens.
Mm.
If they'd found that code, I could have had my head cut off.
Yeah.
and so would 9 others. And I took my card to Colonel Toosey and said, can you see anything wrong with that card? And he looked at it and said, no, why? I said, there's a code in it. So he examined it. No, I can't see anything. Right, so off it went. 9 months later, I got the reply and I told Colonel Toosey, they've read the code. So I said, next time we get a card, I'll send messages. My father was a journalist and he used to go to the Ministry of Information every day. And I said to Colonel Toosey, if you can steal some cards and give them to me, I'll put anything you want on there for the War Office. I can do anything. And then I'll send them off. And when I did send my cards, I never sent them to my parents' name, always to my fiancée, because if it was discovered, they would look at the name, they wouldn't find my name. And that Colonel Toosey said, no, you put the messages on, and I'm not having you risk your neck for it. You give them to me, I'll send them. He said, I've got connections in the War Office, and so I crossed, in the crossings out, I put how many there were of us, how many dead, how many alive, Dutch, Australians, us, places and things like that.
And this was simply in the way that you scored out.
Yeah.
You were using Pittman's shorthand strokes to do it.
Yeah, I've got one, I'll show it to you.
How did you learn Pittman's shorthand? From your father?
No, my father, as I say, was a journalist. So was my brother. And I wanted to be one. And when I left school with no qualifications for anything, I went to the editor of the Daily Express. I just walked in. He was a friend of the family. And he said, what are you doing here? So I said, well, I've come to ask for a job. He said, what? I said, I want to be a journalist. And he said, well, if you are your father's son, I'll give you a job anytime. And so he said, when would you like to start? I said, I'll start now. No, he said, come tomorrow and I'll take you round the place. And as I went, he said, by the way, what are your speeds? So I thought, how does he know I'm an athlete? I said, what distances? He said, shorthand and typing. Well, I said, I don't know anything about that. He said, you've come to get a job on a paper and you don't know shorthand. The lift boy does shorthand here. Everybody does it. You learn shorthand and typing, I'll give you a job. So I shot up the road to enrol at the Polytechnic on a commercial course to learn speed, shorthand and typing. I didn't tell my parents. They were going to have to pay for all this. I just thought I'd bounce off. To start with, I thought I'd come home tonight and say, by the way, I'm a journalist. And that didn't work. I thought, well, I'd come home and say, well, I've enrolled to learn shorthand and typing. It's the only exam I've ever passed. I got 99% in the shorthand and 98% in the typing. My mother, who at one time was the fastest typist in the world, tried to teach me shorthand, and she was hopeless. There was no way I was ever going to learn shorthand with her. It was an awful hieroglyphics, and yet they were shoving me into it. And I remember coming down out of my bed one night, my father and mother were sitting round the fire in the dining room, and I had my shorthand books, and I threw them on the fire in front of them, and I said, now you can kill me. I thought they would. You know, I deserved to be killed for that. And my mother spotted that I was on the verge. I would have killed myself. So I never learned. And then when I knew that I had to learn to get this job, I never recall ever having worked. I just took to it. I have an hour shorthand each day at the Poly, an hour's trip back in the train revising it, an hour at home doing the homework, an hour in the morning revising again. I knew it backwards, forwards and sideways. I can read it now, upside down, anything. Mm. So I learnt it so well. And my mother could write shorthand at 180 words a minute. Mm. And I don't know how I thought this scheme up. It's an amazing what comes to you to do, and how I did it, and how she spotted it.
Yes.
So I'm sure I'm the only prisoner of war that established contact with England.